Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
This recession started a bit more than, what, 2 years ago now, right? We are 8-something million jobs lost and counting. The White House offered a modest proposal on that today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done. You can build a team online at elance.com. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Thursday today. This one is the 11th of February, and it is great to have you here. The 3 feet of snow still on the ground in Washington didn't stop the Obama administration from the swift completion of its economic rounds today. The White House let fly with its annual economic report to Congress this morning. 462 pages chock full of financial figures and forecasts. One of the headline numbers, not that we want to spoil it for those who can, for the first time, download the economic report onto their ebook readers. Anyway, the headline number there is 95,000, as in the White House expects the economy to create an average of 95,000 jobs every month this year. That is a turnaround, albeit a modest one, from the job losses that have been piling up since the recession began. Whether it's a realistic number? That's another question entirely, as our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
Adding 95,000 jobs a month is a lot better than losing hundreds of thousands, like the shrinking economy did most of last year, but that won't bring down the unemployment rate. Still, the head of the President's Economic Council, Christina Romer, is confident of a turnaround.
We did our usual forecasting procedure, which is a very complicated thing, using lots of professional forecasters at the various agencies.
I'd say lots of luck to that prediction.
Economic consultant Gary Schilling figures the economy will maybe grow 1% this year with little to no job creation.
The question is, you know, where is it going to come from? Because housing is just saturated with excess inventories. Other sectors of the economy, state and local governments, hey, they're retrenching. They have huge deficit problems, and U.S. consumers simply aren't buying at the rate they were earlier.
But Princeton University economist Peter Kennan hopes the reality is the economy grows more jobs than the White House is predicting.
The more distressing aspect of it is that it translates into little more than 1.1 million for the whole of the year 2010, which is barely enough to keep the unemployment rate from rising.
The president's advisors do see accelerating job growth next year, averaging nearly 200,000 jobs a month. That'll bring unemployment down, although it'll still average higher than 9% for 2011. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Thanks to the snow, it's going to be another couple of weeks before Congress hears directly from Toyota executives. Hearings scheduled this week have had to be pushed back. But lawmakers are getting an earful from some state governors. Marketplace's Elisa Roth explains now why Mississippi, Alabama, Indiana, and Kentucky are sticking up for the car company.
It's not that these governors think Toyota should get a free pass.
The company must quickly correct the problem. They may well need to be fined or pay some appropriate penalty. Nobody's quarreling with that.
That's Mitch Daniels of Indiana. He and his fellow governors just want to make sure Toyota gets a fair chance. They're worried that Congress is biased because the government owns GM and Chrysler. And yes, there is an element of self-interest here, too.
No apologies for looking out for thousands of employees in our state and the company which has employed them.
It isn't unusual for governors to stick up for big employers in their states. Greg LeRoy directs Good Jobs First. It's an organization that promotes accountability and economic development. He says the only thing unusual here is that Toyota's a foreign company.
There is an element of them establishing a track record here of standing up for an employer, even a foreign-based employer, saying, we'll stand by you even if you have a rough spot.
He says money is so scarce these days, governors are always looking for more investment in their states, and which country the money comes from matters less and less. Governor Daniels says he's sticking by the Japanese. And in case you think he's all talk...
Do you drive a Toyota?
I ride in one, the official state vehicle. is a Toyota built in Princeton, Indiana.
The official state vehicle in Kentucky is a Ford, but Steve Beshear, the governor, was quick to tell me his wife drives a Toyota 4Runner, her second. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, better than it has been. We'll have the details. Yeah, we'll have them when we do the numbers. The euro gave ground against the dollar today, also against the yen, and against the British pound sterling. That is probably not the result European Union officials were hoping for after their meeting today on the great Greek debt crisis of 2010. But then again, they didn't really say much about how they might help Athens avoid a default. Here to help explain what they might do is our European Bureau Chief, Stephen Beard. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
As far as we know them, Stephen, what does this plan, this rescue plan, I guess you could say, contain?
The details are pretty thin on the ground. I mean, what we had today was a lot of verbal support for the Greeks, a lot of fine talk about backing the Greek government to the hilt with coordinated measures, but no actual specifics. The likelihood is that if the Greeks come under sustained attack again, and if they're unable to borrow or if they even default, then the rest of the Eurozone will step in and guarantee Greek government bonds. But in return, the EU is demanding the Greeks must carry out their pledge to cut their public spending and bring down their budget deficit.
Yeah, and therein lies the rub, right? So what are the odds of the Greeks actually doing that?
Well, the omens aren't good. We've seen this week some really big protest rallies in Athens, even before the cuts begin to bite. People have been out protesting over the planned freeze in public sector pay. Air traffic controllers have been on strike. Even tax collectors walked out, which is hardly going to help a government that's struggling to balance the books. Greece is in a terrible mess. And as Neil McKinnon of VTP Capital points out, deficit reduction there is going to be very painful.
Further cuts in spending could well be very damaging, destabilizing, put them straight back into recession, as well as resulting in an escalation of social and political discontent.
All right, Stephen, so here comes the what's all the fuss about question. You ready?
Yeah.
So for as nice a place as Greece is, its economy is a small percentage of the entire European economy. But if you look at some place like California, a much larger economy in arguably worse shape, there's no bailouts coming over here. So what is this actual crisis all about?
It's about the fear of contagion. It's the domino theory. I mean, the idea is that if Greece defaults, that raises a giant question mark over other European countries in a similar situation, Spain, Portugal, Ireland, even Italy. And if they defaulted and their economies went into a tailspin, big German and French banks would take a massive hit. You know, German banks alone have lent more than $250 billion to Spain, more than $200 billion to Ireland. Then there is the bigger worry that mass defaults by these countries, which make up about 20% of the output of the Eurozone, would seriously undermine confidence in the euro as a currency.
And that would trickle down through the rest of the global economy.
Indeed.
All right, then next steps for Greece and the Eurozone, Stephen.
Well, there is undoubtedly a question about the future of the euro. This whole crisis has exposed, or at least put the spotlight on, a fundamental flaw in the euro. It is a currency without a country. You've got one currency, one central bank, but 16 different governments. There's no one central authority controlling these eurozone budgets. So this tension between countries that keep their public spending under control and those that don't is bound to erupt from time to time. And one result of this crisis could be that the European Commission is going to take a lot more control over the public finances of Eurozone member states. That'll mean a loss of sovereignty. It's already started in Greece, and many Greeks don't like it. They see this creeping control by Brussels as a kind of Trojan horse, and the Greeks know all about Trojan
we
horses.
Know how that one turned out. Stephen Beard at the European desk in London. Thank you, Stephen.
Okay, Kai.
The head of the Anglican Church is no fan of the global financial industry. The Archbishop of Canterbury has been stirring up controversy in England with some fairly strongly worded sermons and statements on that subject. A couple of weeks ago, he brought those views to Wall Street. Trinity Church, right on the corner of Wall Street and Broadway, held a conference on how to build an ethical economy. On stage with him was frequent Marketplace contributor Susan Lee. So we asked her to share her thoughts on the ethics of economics from her perspective as both an economist and a theologian.
Sharing the stage with the Archbishop of Canterbury forced me to wear both my hats at the same time. And since ethics are the common ground for theology and economics, the result wasn't as loaded with conflict as you might think. Both theologians and economists are interested in improving the lives of all humans. Both groups agree on policy goals like low unemployment and sustainable growth. In fact, these goals are in harmony with the definition offered by the Archbishop. He said, an ethical economy is one where we care for our neighbor by creating conditions so the most vulnerable aren't abandoned. Well, this is a description of capitalism in the U.S. In capitalism, economic wherewithal comes from increasing rates of growth, or in the economist's favorite image, a bigger pie. And the sharing of this pie with the most vulnerable is mandated through a social safety net. Over the past six decades, our economy has enjoyed good economic growth, so we have a bigger pie. And because of the moral consensus to protect the most vulnerable, we've given more of this pie through the social safety net. But here's the hooker. Economists are interested in how to make the pie larger. Theologians are interested in how to divide the pie. And so many theologians treat capitalism like a Chinese menu. They pick the wealth distribution parts and discard the wealth creation parts. They assume there can be work without incentives, enterprise without income inequality, investment without market rates of return. But picking and choosing isn't an option. Capitalism is an integrated system, and it's this integration that creates the wealth making, which is the basis for wealth sharing. Well, the Archbishop listened to me politely, but I didn't convince him. I was, however, thrilled to take my views to the top, so to speak.
Susan Lee is an economist and a theologian based in New York City. You can take your views to the top. And if you can't get there, well, send them to us. Go to marketplace.org, click on that link that says contact. Coming up, migrant workers say goodbye, Dubai.
They also are hopeful that the gravy train can find other routes. Europe is opening up. East Asia is opening up.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials jumped 105 points today. 1% ended at 10,144. The NASDAQ rose 29 points, 1.3%, finished at 2177. The S&P 500 climbed 10 points, nearly 1%, closed at 1078. 3M added 2% today, helped by an analyst upgrade. Caterpillar climbed more than 5%. Lennar hammered on almost 9%. The homebuilder bought a stake in $3 billion worth of loans from the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. Activision dusted on nearly 10% today. The world's biggest video game maker reported fourth quarter earnings that topped analyst estimates. Philip Morris International puffed up nearly 4%. The company announced a stock repurchase plan. As base metals and oil climbed, so did companies that mine them. Freeport-McMoRan, producer of copper and gold, dug up 4.4% today. Price on the 10-year T-note fell, pushed the yield up to 3.72%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term goals at Vanguard.com. And by MassMutual, for 158 years, providing policyholders with solutions to help meet their financial goals at MassMutual.com. Keep an eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to updates on the economy and business, watch the Marketplace whiteboards, and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org on your iPhone.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department is scheduled to release its monthly retail sales report after a day's delay due to the storm. Designer Threads take stage in New York, where Fashion Week continues in Bryant Park. And director Roman Polanski's The Ghost Rider premieres at the Berlin International Film Festival. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. American skier Lindsey Vonn said on her Twitter feed this afternoon she's using a bunch of creams and painkillers to try to get over that shin injury she has. Bad weather on the slopes near Vancouver put off a scheduled training run today, which will give her a bit more time to rest. But when and if Vonn does finally race, you can bet her results and the results of every other competition up there are going to be all over Twitter and YouTube and Facebook almost as soon as they're done. You might have thought that would have meant an end to tape-delayed television broadcasts of the games, but then you wouldn't be working at NBC if you thought that. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genza reports now on why these Olympics ought to offer a medal for the best spoiler alert.
Full disclosure here, I love to ski, but I'm not skiing this season, so I'm really, really looking forward to watching the Olympic skiers. Remember when downhill powerhouse Bodie Miller came in just short of a medal in 06?
So a mistake by Bodie Miller at a critical part of the course, and he's off the podium.
That news hit the internet instantly, but it was easy to avoid if you wanted to be surprised in primetime. It's not so easy this year, courtesy of texting and Twitter. But NBC will still tape delay some major Olympic events and show them later in primetime when audiences are big and the ad money pours in. Now, I don't care if I know how things will turn out. I just want to see top athletes glide down courses that would flip me into a faceplant. Sports economist Andrew Zimbalist says, I've got company.
Most people who are watching the Olympics are not looking so much at scores. They're looking more at the beauty of the competition.
NBC is banking on that, but it's also policing the internet to make sure its exclusive Olympic video doesn't end up on YouTube or other sites. Roger Knoll says, good luck with that. He studies the economics of sports at Stanford.
The problem is that you're going to have, 25,000 people at a ski jump event with their cell phones taking pictures of it. And there's no way NBC is going to be able to stop that.
But media analyst Hal Vogel says NBC still has a major advantage.
The large bulk of the population, I believe, wants to enjoy the full spectacle in full digital glory. And you don't get that on your computer screen to the same extent.
At least not yet. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
While the Vancouver Olympic Committee has had to resort to trucking in snow to cover its ski and snowboard courses, most of the eastern seaboard of these United States has more snow on the ground than it knows what to do with. Also on the ground over the past couple of days have been thousands of airplanes and passengers who couldn't get where they're going. That includes one Scott McCartney, who happens to write the middle seat column for the Wall Street Journal. We have dialed him up to talk about the lingering economic effects of an unusually large snowstorm, to quote the Daily Show. Scott, good to talk to you again.
Good to be back with you.
This is almost too funny, but you're actually stuck in Boston now, aren't you?
I am. I came up here for a snow story and, of course, got stuck.
All right. Well, other than the Journal having to spend some more money on hotel rooms for you, do we have any way to estimate how many people out there, how many flights got stuck and people are trapped?
Well, we can count flights and we can extrapolate from that. So far over the past week, there have been about 20,000 flights in the U.S. that have been canceled. It's a staggering number, a fairly large percent of flights. If you figure that, average flight may have 100 passengers on it, then you're looking at somewhere around 2 million people who have been affected by this. And look at some average fare data, and you can make a back-of-the-napkin guess that there's about $200 million worth of airline revenue that's been affected by the storm. And airlines typically may lose about half of that.
Well, and that's not even counting meetings that didn't happen, deals that didn't get done, all of that.
Yeah, all of that. For hotels, some of them may end up empty because people didn't show up. Some of them may end up full because people like me are stuck longer. But it affects restaurants. It affects, you know, anybody who has anything to do with travel.
I imagine this would only be marginal at best, but can the airlines mitigate any of these lost revenues by not having to buy gas and use the airplanes and other expenses?
Yeah, that's exactly right. They do mitigate some of it, and a lot of the revenue they do hang on to because people are going to fly later if they got delayed, or in some cases they're going to take their non-refundable ticket and apply it to a different trip. But in storm situations, when you do ground that many flights, you do save quite a bit on your gas bill. You don't pay landing fees for those 20,000 flights that have been canceled. You probably end up paying your crews for canceled flights. There is some savings for airlines in costs, but at the end of the day, it's still very costly for them.
You know, Scott, I couldn't help but think during this whole mess of the JetBlue episode over the past couple of years and also other airlines where they got stuck because of a storm out on the tarmac, 8, 10, 12 hours, whatever it was,
right.
All kinds of negative publicity. Was that a factor, do you think, in the airlines just saying, you know what, the heck with it, we're not even going to try?
You know, I think it was a factor. I think in general, airline operations have grown more cautious. And not just because of the JetBlue episode, the American episode, Delta's had. They've all had their different experiences. Continental Express last summer in Rochester, Minnesota, a plane stuck overnight because of weather situation. So they've gotten more cautious about trying to fly in bad weather, not from a safety perspective, but just from the standpoint of, you know, that plane could get diverted somewhere. We could have a problem. We could end up with people stranded. And the government's gotten involved in stranding issues. And I think in general, airlines just say the prudent thing to do is not try.
Yeah. All right. Now to you, when are you going to get home?
Tomorrow, I hope. Went to the airport, stood in line, couldn't get a seat today, so I have a seat for tomorrow, and let's hope it goes.
You see, everybody, even the travel editor at the Wall Street Journal has some problems. Scott McCartney, thanks a lot.
Good to be with you.
There's good news today for one slice of the American labor market. The Department of Labor announced new rules to protect temporary farm workers, mostly in the areas of wages and safety. Those two topics are of concern to low-income workers everywhere. And in South Asia, another group of migrant workers is feeling the pinch, as once booming Dubai sends a lot of its many foreigners home. Raymond Thibodeau reports now from the southern Indian state of Kerala.
Abdul Wahab sits in his home in Kochi. His wife, Niza, pours glasses of orange drink for him and their two children. This is the first time in 24 years that he's returned from Dubai for more than just a few weeks' home leave. Abdul and about 1,700 other dock workers at the Dubai Ports Authority were recently laid off from their jobs. No warning, no efforts to get them alternative employment. It all happened in one day.
In the shop. All of a sudden, and after the shift, they came and given them the paper that your job is finished. You can go back to your country. There is no time to think. All their camp is surrounded by the military, and there is no way up to struggle or agitate. So simply they came back.
Abdul's homecoming is bittersweet. He says tough times lie ahead in India, but his wife Niza couldn't be happier.
We only hope that he is back for good. Without him, it is sometimes a struggle to raise our two children, especially since I also must work.
Abdul, like many South Asian migrant workers, had looked on the Gulf countries as a gravy train. The oil boom of the 1970s made them rich, the kinds of places that could finance huge construction projects.
That triggered massive demand for overseas workers.
Binod Kadria, an economics professor, directs the International Migration and Diaspora Studies Project at Jawaharlal Nehru University in Delhi.
That was a golden opportunity for the low-skilled, middle-level skilled people to find highly paid jobs.
He says most of those workers came from India, and most of the Indians came from the southern state of Kerala, where one in six workers is employed overseas. But now that Dubai's economy has been hit by the global downturn, and construction projects are being abandoned or reconsidered, migrant workers are being shipped home by the plane loads.
That psychology is on now that it's coming to an end. They have that sense, but they also are hopeful that the gravy train can find other routes. Europe is opening up. East Asia is opening up.
Kerala's economy is counting on it. Carolyn's working abroad sent home about $5 billion a year, boosting Kerala's economy by nearly 25%.
Welcome to Pravasalogam, the relevance of dates on the plight of hundreds of Malayalis who have been lured to Gulf to seek employment.
Rafiq Ravuthar is host of Migrants World. It's a TV show about Indians working overseas. He says returning Indians complain that even in a rising India, the salaries are way too low. Some have had to take their children out of private schools. But Rafiq has noticed something else.
If they are coming back to Kerala, they will not do those kind of jobs they done in Dubai. They will not do it in Kerala.
Not at Kerala rates, at least. Rafiq says it's also a pride thing. Any job in Dubai was seen as so prestigious that bachelors advertising for a wife would often add works in Dubai. But in the present climate, with jobs in the desert kingdom evaporating like mirages, potential brides may not be so impressed. In Kochi, India, I'm Raymond Thibodeau for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to strengthen America by empowering young people to achieve educational success beyond high school. And by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
A final note this afternoon, an update from the foreclosure wars. A couple of weeks ago, we did a story about how banks have become increasingly unwilling to foreclose, not necessarily out of altruism, but because of the damage that taking a devalued house onto its books can do to its balance sheet. Along those lines, Citigroup is out with a new pilot program today. Borrowers facing foreclosure can stay in their homes an extra 6 months, the bank says, if they turn over their deeds, or promise to anyway, at the end of that period and keep the home in reasonable shape. They get relocation assistance, too, $1,000. Citi says it figures the program will help about 1,000 families. Last year in this country, there were, and we know because we checked this afternoon, almost 3 million homeowners who faced foreclosure. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Thursday afternoon. Today, the Dow jumped 105 points, 1%, ended at 10,144. The NASDAQ rose 29 points, 1.3%, finished at 2177. The S&P 500 up as well, 10 points, nearly 1%, closed at 1,078. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. You got to be up early for it, though. Next time on this broadcast, why your favorite ski destinations might be in for a green makeover.
If they're considering grading more runs, ski areas should really reconsider that process because of the environmental impacts.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.